afternoon, and welcome to this special edition of Dispatches. This is Walter Fordham, standing in for Julia Sahabian, who is unable to be here today. And we are very honored to welcome our esteemed guest, the Venerable Khandva Rinpoche.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us today, Rinpoche.
Thank you.
Rinpoche, I think for the past many years, you have been one of many Tibetan teachers who have been carrying on for Trungpa Rinpoche since his parinibbana, following his aspiration to bring Dharma to the West and teaching at his many centers. And you have also taken on many of his students as your own students at this point, people who now see you as their object of refuge in the Dharma. And I think what many of us are very interested to hear is how you view his life and his work.
I think in your question, two or three uncomfortable moments, I would say. One is to even imagine that one can assume to continue, as you said, Rinpoche's work. Trungpa Rinpoche's work is, as I say, a dog trying a lion's leap. And so I have been very, very fortunate in being able to learn so much from the Shambhala Mandala. Trungpa Rinpoche had passed away when I first came to the established major centers of what used to be Vajradhatu, today is Shambhala. And since then, I don't think I have been able to teach anything more but have learned tremendously. Mm. That's absolutely true. Because as children, as we grew up, we had heard about the students of Trungpa Rinpoche and Trungpa Rinpoche's activities from the teachers who were traveling to the West at that time, as well as many of our teachers who would speak in very high regard, with very high regard and respect to Trungpa Rinpoche as one of the most accomplished masters of their times. And so I always knew of Rinpoche's manifestation and his activities, but to be able to see it, and especially with regard to the Western students and his vision and his absolute generosity in bringing the Dharma in so much fullness, still amazes me. I was struck the first time that I began to be, I would think it was in a formal way, I think it was at the Kamazong in Boulder. Since then and until now, and as you all begin to bring out more of Rinpoche's work and his many of his teachings that were not formed into books that were easily accessible, but today as we learn and as we hear more and from his students, simple things. And it just is extraordinary just to find the wealth of ocean of wisdom and generosity and kindness that Rinpoche had. I was speaking with one of Rinpoche's students just recently, and we were going through a commentary of a text. And I was going through a point where we were talking about the syllable Shri in terms of the mantra recitation. And I went on speaking about what Shri is from a very traditional perspective. And at that time, one of Rinpoche's students, and that's Peter Lieberson, mm-hmm. You know him. Mm-hmm. And so he said, well, Trungpa Rinpoche explained it as docking into the humor of the sky. And when you hear something like that, then you begin to really get struck with, I do not think of anyone who could come up with that expression that just hits the point, but using a modern language, but being able to just pin it exactly. And there is no traditional elaboration on it. There is mm-hmm. no philosophy, but it hits the point where it should be, and that's what Dharma is. Mm-hmm. And each day I find that more and more of Rinpoche's work, and that's what has been a great encouragement and an inspiration. Mm. And his students continue to amaze me with their devotion. Mm. Long after, many years after Rinpoche passed away, that still it continues with that amount of dedication. And as they say, what a teacher was like is often seen by how the students are. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, something that I've always been very, very amazed at. And I find myself more lucky than anyone else. Mm.
Were any of his books available when you were growing up in Mindraling Monastery?
At the monastery. Not at the monastery. I did not. But I grew up with teachers who looked down on reading anything English. And so that could also be. We grew up at that time. But as soon as I started traveling, yes, I've read most of Rinpoche's works.
And what was that like? What was it like to see the Dharma in a different language?
I think it... as I was saying to a group of people, I think yesterday, is the same thing. We never, as we grow up in a traditional monastic setting, know certain things, such as public talk, is what I was joking about the other night also.
Public talk.
That's a new concept. And as I came, I always used to go through Rinpoche's books just to see how you could say the same thing in a less conventional way. And part of 10 years of my life, I could say, is just trying to follow or gain inspiration from Rinpoche's work and being able to do that. And so that's the way it is. It's just this, it's almost a therma in its own, I would say. It's almost a treasure in its own, is that you can read a passage and then you can just go through layers and layers of how you could actually approach the same topic. And what I find very, very inspiring always is you don't teach the Dharma to boast your knowledge.
Yeah.
But you teach the Dharma to benefit another person. And you teach the Dharma without caring for your reputation. That's remarkable. And so I think I wouldn't say that the traditional people don't do that. They do that. All teachers do that as best as they can. But in our times, I think a living example definitely comes in the form of Trungpa Rinpoche.
I understand that your father was someone that Trungpa Rinpoche had great admiration for.
And I think it was also the other way around too.
As well.
Yes. Some parts that I have seen referring to Rinpoche. I was, one time, I was sitting serving lunch or dinner or some meal, and as attendants were serving, I was holding the tray. And this was during the Theraswat initiation in India at that time at our monastery. And Khenso Rinpoche, Dingo Khenso Rinpoche and Meling Tichen Rinpoche, they were speaking about something. And the time when I came into the room, both were talking about this remarkable teacher called Trungpa Rinpoche. And what is he doing nowadays was some kind of conversation. This was in the early 80s. 79, 80, I think, between that time. And they were discussing about that. And then I remember Mindling Tichen Rinpoche talk about how he and his brother, who had passed away in Tibet, Mindling Tichen Rinpoche and Shabdrung Rinpoche, both of them were studying at the Dzogchen Monastery at one point, receiving a cycle of teachings. And Trungpa Rinpoche happened to be there. And how both of them were struck by the wealth of knowledge, and we say the sharpness of the mind of Trungpa Rinpoche at that point. And Meling Tichen Rinpoche was telling Khenso Rinpoche that we had all this hierarchical in the among the Tibetans, and the Meling Tichens or Dungses, the sort of the son who takes on the throne, they are always accorded a lot of respect, and the hierarchical, they are very high there. But he was saying, but it was so difficult because whenever questions were asked, there were all these high-ranking teachers who were left aghast at the answers of Trungpa Rinpoche that he was giving. And His Holiness's younger brother, Shabdrung Rinpoche, was also known as an emanation of Manjushri. And so very, very well known for his learnedness and understanding. And His Holiness said, well, my brother, my younger brother was the intelligent one, so they became more close than me among themselves. And so that was the conversation they were having. And then on another occasion, I remember Rinpoche telling us that we were, during a course of teaching, Rinpoche was saying, someone like Trungpa Rinpoche today, that if you all have the opportunity of meeting, you should exert effort in meeting him, because he was saying, following Padmasambhava's activities, if you look at the life of Padmasambhava, you find him learned in all different capacities. And he was saying, an example of somebody who followed that path of being learned in not only just Dharma, but in all different aspects. and especially in the field of sciences and art. He was saying he did not know at this time in his generation anyone more learned. And I always used to wonder at how it was. And then coming to the West, as you see, the immense amount of work. And also the blending of many things that are there, that also strikes me as very much. I come from a very traditional Tibetan background.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Some of Rinpoche's works, when I see, I find, you know, sometimes even we all experience that. Some things are very good. Some things are out of the stubbornness of the Tibetan mind. And we just say that this is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes great courage to learn the best of other traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And to make one's own better because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a lot of courage. Mm-hmm. To give your own to learn from something else takes a lot of courage. And that also mm-hmm. we find in Trungpa Rinpoche. And from that, I think the Shambhala Mandala has originated, which has been, I think, very helpful for many, many students all mm-hmm. across the world.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines of taking teachings beyond the tradition that they've been in for many years, one of Trungpa Rinpoche's aspirations for bringing Dharma to the West was that we would, in some ways, go back and learn directly from the Sanskrit and the Indian form of Buddhism.
Mm.
And as you, I'm sure you know, the pronunciation of many terms mm-hmm. and mantras and the
yes.
Shambhala Mandala is an attempt to say things in the way that they might have been said in
right.
the traditional Sanskrit.
Uh-huh.
And this was very much something that he aspired to seeing carried on in the Western world
mm-hmm.
Amongst Dharma practitioners. And I'm wondering, I've always wondered if other Tibetan teachers agree with him, see some value in going back to the Sanskrit terminology.
It has always taken a revolutionary thinker to bring about changes uh-huh. in the history of 1,200 years of Tibetan Buddhism. Any remarkable teacher that today we really remember and are extremely grateful to, in their time, were revolutionaries or Renaissance thinkers, almost, and new thinkers. Probably not so much accepted or liked during their time as much after their passing away or after time moved on. And I think changes to occur always requires that two things. One is that the one bringing the change has to be absolutely brave and courageous and a visionary in many ways. And the two is that it has to be skillfully done. It has to be very skillfully done. I really think it's very important because Tibet and the Tibetanization of many things, if we look at just the pronunciation of Sanskrit, we're very attached to our wrong way of pronouncing things. And uh-huh. and that's why half the time, because I lived in India and grew up speaking Hindi, so still there are some words that I can understand. Some years I studied Sanskrit, so I can understand a few things. But still, when I utter them, I always utter them in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why do I do that if I carefully think about it? Then it could be for various, we can always come up with all kinds of reasons. But I think it's very important that if you can retain the original as much as possible, one should do that. And I don't think teachers would be reluctant to do it if they were able to just, I think, remember it a little bit more in doing it. So I find, for example, I can take myself as an example. I can always do Vajra Mu. But when I'm alone, I always will say Benza Mu.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of
mm-hmm.
Vajra, I'll say Benza.
Mm-hmm. By the way, that was true of Trungpa Rinpoche as well. When he would say
mantras,
he would insist that we would say, you know, say it as close as we could to the original Sanskrit. But he would say it as well when he would give a talk. You know, he would say Padma. He would say the traditional
Pema. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, instead of Pema.
Mm-hmm.
But when he did a mantra recitation.
I think that's very true. I think so. I've always also thought the same thing, is that Americans don't need to, or the Westerners don't need to make the same mistakes as the Tibetans did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very true.
Mm-hmm.
It's when we go to receive transmissions or abhishekas, for example, you don't go to receive transmissions and abhishekas from anyone. Preferably, what is kept in mind is you take transmissions from the person who has the closest lineage to the original founder of the teachings. So if you look at let's say, if you're going to receive the Kama teachings or the Terzo teachings or something of the Nyingtik transmissions or something, you don't look at who's the first readily available person who can give you the transmission. In today's times, people do that. But originally, what would be good is you look at who has the transmissions in the most purest and the authentic lineage,
mm-hmm.
and preferably with the least number of people in between the first who gave mm-hmm. to the moment that you are receiving. So if the fewer the people there are, it's always closer to the lineage. And so if you take that same theory, then Buddhism is that which originated in India, and then it grew in Tibet and other countries, and then it began to now be sort of taught and practiced in the West. But it isn't necessary that Westernization of Buddhism be solely dependent upon the Tibetans. You can actually take benefit from the Tibetans, but connect your way back to the original. And if you can retain the original, I think that's always very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only guess that that might be what Rinpoche was thinking about, too.
That's our understanding, I think, from...
I think so, yes. Tibetans are Tibetans, Americans are Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We have Buddhism. So the Americans have to learn Buddhism, not Tibetan-styled Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Neither do the Tibetans have to become Americans, nor the Americans have to try and become Tibetans.
In your own lineage, bringing Dharma to the West and setting up Lotus Garden in Virginia, do you face problems of keeping things precious and the same and also having to accommodate change? Is that a dynamic that's... In your teachings?
Foremost of all, from your first question, one of the uncomfortable things, I've never believed myself to be a teacher to students. I like to see myself as a needle in the cushion, I always say that. Someone whenever becomes comfortable, I'd like to be the needle that makes it uncomfortable, so that the complacency doesn't come. We've always been so very fortunate in having excellent teachers guide us throughout our lives and as good friends, many of them as good friends. You know, in my life, I always count all my root gurus, of course, whether it is Trichen Rinpoche or whether it is Khenpo Rinpoche or the Kamapa. But on the other hand, our lives were not only brought up by just our root teachers, who have been exceptionally kind and are Buddhas of our times, but many other people, our teachers who taught us calligraphy, how to learn, mm-hmm. grammar, composition, mm-hmm. musical instruments, dharmas, whatever different aspects of liturgy, those are the people who actually sat with us 24 hours a day with our sort of teaching us in every aspect. And so you have to understand that role of a teacher also.
Mm.
At our age and with our degree of experience, immediately assuming to be a root teacher of a student, I think, is not correct. I really don't think that that is correct. It is after years and years of working with a teacher that that should be established as a role. Neither our learning, nor our experiences, nor our age can actually come to a point where you can say, oh, I am your root teacher. That root teacher and root student relationship requires tremendous hard work, tremendous amount of teaching, learning, and practice.
Mm.
And so that's what needs to be clarified. And in that regard, students who study anywhere else as well as in Lotus Garden, and Lotus Garden at this moment is supposedly being formulated as a place of retreat, not really a place to gather students or for students to have many programs, but hopefully a place where they can just sort of disappear. In two ways, either get something out of your practice or die on that land. And that's a very simple way. It's a sort of a retreat place. But I think in general, the challenge that seems to be is people love Dharma and yet are still, I think, finding it very difficult to take the full leap into the Dharma. And that's always been very interesting, and it's understandable because the lifestyle of the Western students is very different. And since most of our Sangha members, community members, are householders, so I'm very mindful of myself being a nun. And the demands I make of the students, sometimes I know, can be very difficult because their lifestyle is very different from a background of monasticism that I come from. And so it's interesting. I'm learning new things. I'm learning to ease up a little bit, I hope. And some say it's happening. Some most say it's not happening. Let's see.
Trungpa Rinpoche studied at the Sechen Monastery with Sechen Khandrul, which I understand Mindraling Rinpoche studied there as well.
Was one of his root gurus,
Gurus. And I also understand that the Sechen Monastery was originally, at least, a Mindraling monastery. Is there a connection? We don't really know that much about Trungpa Rinpoche's actual study, what he studied at Sechen Monastery, and we don't really understand, as far as I know, if he was steeped in the Mindraling tradition himself.
I think you have to understand it in the proper perspective, because lineage and the understanding of lineage is very, very important, something that I think the Western students need to really understand. Lineages are not very clear-cut as one after the other. It's a mishmash of many interconnectedness, and people may be connected to several different kinds of lineages by way of receiving transmissions. Mindraling gained its prominence together with the six main monasteries of or lineages of the Nyingma tradition. Sechen and Dzogchen are the two. Then Peiyu and Kathok are the third and the fourth. And then Dojedrak and Mindraling. These six were the six prominent centers of the Nyingma lineage. Now, during the 17th century, when Mindraling was founded by Minling Derdak Lingba, and the learning, the sort of epicenter of compiled works, Dharma teachings, and revival and recompiling of the Kama teachings, propagation of the Dharma in a much more formatted way, was attributed to the tremendous activity and work of Derdak Lingba, Minling Derdak Lingba. So among the Nyingmas, and as well as other schools of Buddhism, but particularly among the Nyingmas, Derdak Lingba became almost a pioneer in terms of gathering the Kama and the Tema lineage and bringing about a much more genuine, sort of a revival of genuineness and the purity of the lineages. His work and his brother, Lochen Dhammashiri's work, were then renowned throughout Tibet. And from that work, you can find they compiled what is called Dunjum Bumzang, a compiled work, and then later on, Jamgon Kondro Lodo Thaye, Mewar Mubuche, and the various other teachers, the Rime teachers, took on and continued that work on a larger scale. And so the continuity of the non-sectarian movement, especially with these Nyingma teachers' activities, is said to have been motivated by the works of Minling Derdak Lingba and Lochen Dhammashiri. And therefore, subsequently, although all six centers of the Nyingma are very prominent and individual on their own, but it is said that none of them were untouched by the kindness of Lochen Dhammashiri and Derdak Lingba. Particularly, Sechen Monastery took on much of their work. Now, Sechen is a full-established lineage of its own. It's just as Mindraling is a lineage, likewise Sechen is a lineage. But there was so much of a sense of togetherness in the appreciation of the work of Lochen and Derdak Lingba. Therefore, all the rituals, the learnings, the sciences, as well as especially the practice part, the ritual practice part, was cultivated from the Mindraling tradition. So Sechen and Mindraling both practiced the same liturgies. So the Trukus of Sechen came and studied from Mindraling. Mindraling Trukus went into Sechen, and there was a sense of so much sameness that it was almost seen as one. Now, Mindraling, as in, within Mindraling, now this is sort of our own inner sort of story. Whenever you have more senior teachers in Mindraling from whom, let's say, other monasteries, younger Trukus are studying, people will always say, well, your monastery is the branch monastery of Mindraling. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is under Mindraling. That shouldn't be taken as such. And so Sechen practices, and for example, in the recent times, then Dingwa Khenzo Rinpoche, being the grandfather of Sechen Rabjam Rinpoche, practiced all Mindraling. Sechen Monastery still practices all Mindraling. does that make Shechen under mineraling? That would be a very disrespectful way of putting it.
Uh-huh.
But there is a sameness of almost, there's no divisibility. There is no separateness in terms of practice and method. So combining on the works or formed on the works, then it is the same. But as a respect that one has to give to each individual practice or each individual lineage, then these are the six main individual lineages. And Trungpa Rinpoche then had Jian Chinse as well as Shichen Kongtru particularly, from whom they received teachings. What I know is they received together the Guhai Garba,
mm-hmm.
a cycle of teachings together. And I think if we look back in the traditional way of receiving transmissions, then as Nyingma teachers or from Nyingma teachers, what would you receive? You would receive the various transmissions of the Kama and the Tema lineages. You would receive the Nyingthik, the four Nyingthiks. You would receive the Guhai Garba teachings, the Mahaati teachings. And these would be the sequential way of approaching. So I don't think it's a very difficult thing to find out what exactly they might have received, because by and large, all of the teachers receive the same kind of transmissions.
I see. Yeah. That's very helpful. Thank you. Yeah, that's very helpful. Do you have any more stories that you overheard when you were serving your father and hearing him discuss Trungpa Rinpoche and other teachers?
I think I can't recollect any one particular that might be, but there was a great deal of curiosity, definitely. People would travel to the West and come back, and then the first thing they would ask is, what is Trungpa Rinpoche doing? I remember that.
Was there concern about what he was doing as well?
No, I don't think it was. Tibetans are not really concerned as a worry concern. They're more sort of, what do you call them? I think wonderment concern, a sense of what is being done. There's a good thing. Among the teachers that we grew up with, you will find that nobody suspects each other's work, or nobody is dubious about each other's work. Nobody is critical. I never saw anyone critical of each other's work. There's a sense of amazement at the diversity of activities, definitely. And so I think in the moment where Kalu Rinpoche began to travel and Kamapa, his illness, the 16th Karmapa, began to travel, and Jamgon Kongtrul Rinpoche began to travel a lot with the other Yapsis also. But then more attendants began to travel after that. And then Kenzo Rinpoche began to travel and attendants. So we always heard more directly from the attendants about the different ways of res- And then I think when Kenzo Rinpoche began to travel, and part of what I can reflect or remember at this moment is that almost all the teachers and their students were really struck by the seriousness of the Dharma with which the people were practicing.
Mm.
And the only thing that they seemed to be amazed with was the uniforms, the different uniforms and clothings that Trungpa Rinpoche was photographed in or that they saw in. And so that they couldn't understand very much. And so that was what I remember. And so there would be a long discussion about his amazing work in transforming the minds of the Western students and how he could so eloquently teach. And then they would show pictures of Rinpoche on horseback in military uniforms. And then they would say, but we don't know about this part. One or two moments I remember hearing that.
That's marvelous.
All right. I think when Kenzo Rinpoche passed away, I remember sitting at the, it was during that time when Rinpoche had passed away, and after the ceremonies, we were all returning back from Paro, Bhutan, and all the teachers were leaving in the span of a few days, and teachers traveled with a lot of attendants, and many monks had gone to do various prayers. And I think that was the first time that Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche met with His Holiness my father.
Mm.
Because we happened to be, it was during the ceremonies, but it was more in a formal setting, but in an informal way. His Holiness Mitroling Trichen Rinpoche is not, does not do things out of socially correct reasons, let's say that. You know, he's very strict and doesn't spend much time in sweet talk or any kind of, if he doesn't need to be polite, he won't be polite, to keep it short. But I remember sitting in the waiting room at the airport, and we were all going through a process of, I think, passports or something, and the teachers were asked to wait in a waiting room. And someone said in the next room, at that time he was called Sawang. Sawang was there. And I knew about him, so I told an attendant went to Rinpoche and said, there's a troku there, and he'd like to offer a katak to you. And Rinpoche said, when I go out, I will take the katak. As he said, I will walk out and then I'll take the katak. Is that all right? But I went and I said, it's actually Tungpa Rinpoche's son. And Rinpoche said, oh, Tungpa Rinpoche's son, call him in. And then so he came in, and then they sort of met very briefly at that moment and exchanged katas. But small things like that is where we know the teachers, and there's so much of regard and esteem for Tungpa Rinpoche, that those are the moments that you then see about the respect and what they felt. Mm-hmm. And it's that it still continues in this way, then that's, I think, remarkable.
Our teacher died almost 20 years ago. And since then, I think everyone who regarded him as their root guru has continued on in their own way, in various ways, and it is a wide variety of different paths that people have taken. Is there anything that you would say to us as a sangha, as a mandala, in terms of how we relate to him now?
We relate to a teacher with or without his physical presence in the same way, without any change. Mm-hmm. That's very, very important. There's a sense of mourning a death that should be overcome by Buddhist practitioners. Mm-hmm. Life and death moves on, and who would know that better than Buddhist practitioners? Mm-hmm. Teacher's greatest gift to a student is impermanence. If Rinpoche had continued on, I have always thought how remarkable and how changed Buddhism would be in the West if Rinpoche lived. You know, at least I would say that I would have spent the next 10 years receiving teachings from him. But on the other hand, you do know, probably you wouldn't do it. Isn't it? And to die at the right time teaches you so much more of Dharma than being present for a long time and saying the same thing again and again repeatedly, but never really getting across the mind of the person who's listening to it. I think people have done very well, and as the physical presence of the teacher no longer remains, a student often comes to a point where you feel lost. Recently, Dzogchen Khyentse Rinpoche was saying how after the passing away of Khyentse Rinpoche, he spent a few years without having a reference of a root teacher to refer to, and how much he felt that it was needed that he find someone in his life. And this is coming from one of the very realized teachers of our times. And now that he's receiving more teachings again from other teachers, then how much it has helped him to gain stability in his own practice. And so after that, I began to think about it. It's very true. It's very, very true that we don't rely ourselves alone on our own understanding of the Dharma, because you never know when habitual tendencies reoccur again and again and mind becomes swayed by our own neurosis. So as students move on to receiving teachings from other teachers, I think that's also very good. You have to remember that someone like Tungpa Rinpoche himself spent his entire life, no matter how learned he was, but still learning something every time. Mm-hmm. And these are also the generation of teachers you hear who used to just carry a backpack and walk from one village to the next village looking at who is available to give them more transmissions and teachings. And that's how all our root teachers grew up with. And for us to imagine that by being able to receive a few teachings from one's teacher, that is sufficient knowledge of the Dharma, is not healthy for one's own spiritual understanding and growth. And therefore it is essential that, and I think it's good that people move on and receive teachings from many different teachers, and I think that's very, very essential. But the core relationship that you have with your root guru, with or without the presence of his physical body, shouldn't be different at all. You can be in the presence of a teacher and not get anything. You know that. You complain about it and you wonder why you're with this teacher. And, you know, you don't see the enlightened quality of the teacher at all when they're alive. And it changes when the physical presence is not there. And then you see the enlightened quality of their activities. My personal experience is such. My father, His Holiness, when he was active at a younger age, one thing that I used to always find is his sense of always asking. He had one habit, and that was he would ask for his dinner at 5 o'clock in the evening. We all knew we had to serve dinner at 5, but he would always remind us that it had to be at 5. And that really annoyed me for a long time. As soon as he said, "Tsering," I would say, "At 5 o'clock, Rinpoche, yes, I will bring it." Today, when his speech has decreased so much, you really long for him to say the same thing. And so that's how it is that when the presence, physical presence of the teacher is there, I think the mind doesn't see many things of the enlightened quality and the activities. And so I think students should benefit in the absence of the physical body of being able to really see a greater expanse of his teachings and the words and the meaning it contains.
Thank you.
Yeah. If he was still alive, you wouldn't be doing this.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah, that's quite true. Yeah.
I keep thinking about the Tibetans also. How do you teach Tibetans Buddhism? How do you teach monks and nuns Buddhism? In the same way, without saying Americans in a disrespectful way, but as you asked the previous question of Lotus Garden, you keep thinking of how do you educate people on how to live a Buddhistic life, what living Buddhism, as not philosophy Buddhism. People are very good at getting the theory of Buddhism. But when you separate life and philosophy, Dharma, completely as two distinctive things, then there is a very neurotic stage you reach where you know so much and you're not capable of digesting it. And in order to be able to bridge the gap between view and action, you have to live Dharma. Mm-hmm. And you can't live Dharma as an individual. You cannot benefit sentient beings by being an island on its own and only saying, only legal people are allowed to come to my island of compassion. You can't do that. But it's an uphill task getting out from an individualistic society that's so preoccupied with self-sustenance, self-reliance, self-independence, to a non-formed yet happy life. And to be happy and not worry and yet have no form. How do you teach that? Unless you make them go through so many forms that, you know, you don't know which was your original form to begin with. Hmm. Well, that's good. Today it would be imitation. But with Rinpoche, that was the original.
You're speaking about the many different forms that he created?
Hmm. Certainly, mm-hmm. Yes. You know, people have all these. And it's interesting. It's very, very interesting. I was recently speaking with Sophie, I think it was, who was talking about, what was this regiment that you were in? Yeah. The explorers of the phenomenal world. And what did the explorers of the phenomenal world did was... Whenever Rinpoche would go out on a picnic, they would be responsible for finding different things or cutting flowers and so forth. No, something like that, for example. It's very interesting from me. Now, probably it's just, again, guessing from my own way of looking at it. But it is very true. When you live and when you serve in a Dharma community and when you live your life with a teacher, suppleness has to come. You have to be very supple in being available at every moment. Mm-hmm. That's our practice. Mm-hmm. And when you say, every morning you say, I take refuge into the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and my teacher, you're offering your body, speech, and mind. The teacher takes that very seriously. When you surrender to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, you're not leaving something behind to be an independent self. But in the modern world, people still don't mean it literally, almost that degree. So for such a person to be educated in suppleness and to being useful at all moments, I think some form had to be brought about, even mm-hmm. if that form seemed something, just had a name, nothing uh-huh. spectacular about it. But it brought about a conscious awareness in the people to become useful and not just stand there. Otherwise, you would have a group of people who were just glued to the teacher. You know, and then if you become glued to the teacher, uh-huh. self-importance immediately comes
yeah,
in.
Right.
And that's how politics comes in.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, he created all kinds of ways for us to be in his presence.
Mm-hmm.
And the explorers of the phenomenal world was one of them.
Uh-huh.
They went off to cut branches for his flower arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something he could have created his flower arrangements all by himself.
Eventually, without the teacher, then that means you would have to be just delighted in being able to cut branches for the Sangha.
Uh-huh.
And that's, again, something that's not done. You always want to be the carrier of the files, or you want to carry the briefcase, but you don't want to cut the branches. So there's still some learning to do.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
How do you teach hierarchy to a group of people who are supposed to be egoless?
Mm-hmm.
Without hierarchy, no one's going to get things done. You have to have hierarchy. But you have to also have such a flexible hierarchy that can topple over any time. You don't give hierarchy time to become solid.
Mm.
And most important, you have to have the grace and the elegance of being confident about your place and have absolute humility of a non-attachment to it at the same time.
Mm.
What did you think about the Tibetans?
Well, it would depend on the Tibetan, but at one point I remember him very specifically saying, I was the attendant in the room, and so I just overheard the conversation, but he said, the Tibetans don't understand what we're doing.
Hmm, that's quite true.
But it was early. That was early. That was maybe in the early 80s.
Was he ever sad about it?
About the Tibetans?
Hmm.
I don't know if I'm qualified to know. I don't know. I don't know if he was sad about it. He certainly wrote a lot of very lonely poetry about being very lonely.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's an aspect mm-hmm. of it, was in the early days not feeling that there were any of his colleagues who were with him on this adventure in the West.
Yes, I think it's much to do with, it's so comfortable. When you have something that is systematic and it's running on its own, where you don't have to rack your brains with trying to come up with new ideas, it's a cozy place to be in. And so I think breaking form is difficult, as
mm-hmm.
always.
Mm-hmm.
But those were difficult times for the Tibetans also, because the refugee status being very new in a new country, survival was so important at that time.
Right.
So everyone was just trying to set ground
right.
to many things, and revival and sort of grouping of many things were happening. So mm-hmm. much of the concentration was in the East at that moment. But it's interesting when I hear about that. I've mm-hmm. often seen one or two of his poetries and also heard a few things about Tibetans and his relationship, and then that's true.
Hmm.
But to give up so much for the unknown, not totally unknown, but for something that's so new, that's mm-hmm. that's remarkable.
I've also heard that it was very, very difficult for him to take off his robes.
Mm.
It was a very painful transition for him to go through.
Must be. Mm-hmm. Well, it was necessary. It would be a very different Shambhala Mandala if he hadn't taken off his robes.
Yeah.
Mm. Because the mysticism is so much there.
That's right.
I look at the old pictures. I just received today Carolyn Gimmons' book on Lady Diana Mukpo's biography. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture, as in other subsequent pictures also, of Rinpoche's first days of teaching, where he's sitting on the same level of the floor. And for a teacher of his stature to come to that point, it must be I wouldn't say difficult, but it must be a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and how do you as a teacher say to a group of students, as a teacher, I should sit higher than you? That itself requires tremendous skillfulness. And today, all of us know that the preparation work for a visiting teacher is impeccably done best by the Shimbalians.
Hmm.
So from that, and it hasn't taken that, it's not that many years. Tibetans took, what, a couple of hundred years at least before they learned that. And Rinpoche was able to do it, and without him, you were able to continue. I think that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you travel to different other centers, sometimes you see, in the absence of not having had someone teach, people make, I don't think it's disrespectful, but definitely make a lot of mistakes
mm-hmm.
in unknowingly being disrespectful. And so I think kindness of the teachers is in so much in teaching you all aspects other and beyond just the written words of the texts.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
Okay, we'll never finish if we continue. All right.
Well, Rinpoche,
thank you.
On behalf of the Chronicles, thank you very much. And on behalf of all of our listeners, thank you for your teaching and your insight and your wisdom.
Thank you very, very much, too.